Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
For 16 years, Lisa Madigan was one of America's leading state attorney generals and consumer advocates, suing the student loan industry and for-profit colleges who took advantage of young people. She's one of the attorneys general who uncovered the disturbing scandal of pedophilia in the Catholic Church. She went after housing lenders for predatory practices after the 2008 crash. On issue after issue, Lisa Madigan took the lead. She left her job as the Attorney General of Illinois in January. She's currently a fellow at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, where we sat down last week to talk about these battles and her very, very interesting life. Lisa Madigan, my old friend, it's great to see you, especially here at the Institute of Politics, where you're killing it as a fellow this winter quarter, inspiring a bunch of young people. So thank you for being here.
David, thank you for having me. And what you have built here at the University of Chicago, this Institute of Politics, it's just extraordinary. I have loved my time here.
Yeah, well,
your students are great.
It's great to have you. Actually, we can stop right there.
No. Perfect. That's a wrap.
We've known each other so long.
Over 30 years, I think.
The great thing about doing this podcast is that, you know, I have to like study up on people and I learn all kinds of things about them as I did about you, some of which I remembered. But let's start at the beginning. You're born here in Chicago.
From Chicago. Was born in 1966.
Yes.
I'm the ripe age of 52 for a while longer.
and your parents divorced when you were 2 years old.
Right. I was very young at the time.
Yeah. I mean, what do you remember about that?
It wasn't a good situation. So it was a bit of a rough time. You know, I think I did much better the second time around when it comes to dads.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know. Yeah. You're famously, your mom married Mike Madigan, who's the longest serving legislative leader in the country. And we'll get to that. And I don't want to trot on difficult grounds, but how did it impact you as a child, these, what you describe as difficulties?
Well, I was an only child for the first 12 years of my life, and I certainly saw what it was like for a single mom to raise her daughter at a time where not a lot of my friends, if really any of my friends' families, were divorced. Not a lot of the moms who were working full-time to support the family. And so I was kind of, you know, one of those latchkey kids before there really was such a thing that I at least knew about. But in a lot of ways, you know, there's always good with the bad, right? And for me, I had an opportunity to see my mom out there working and to recognize...
What was she doing?
She was working in a law firm. She was a receptionist at a law firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an opportunity because of that, because the people who worked there were very nice. I would sometimes go there after school. And so I grew up in some part in a law firm.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so getting to see what lawyers do, and I still remember when they hired the first woman.
Yeah, I was going to ask about
at the
that.
Law firm, and thinking, wow. And it was really interesting because, you know, of course, all the secretaries and all the receptionists, the paralegals, they were all women. All the lawyers were men. And so when they hired the first woman, it was really interesting because she was somebody who was friends with, obviously, both all the men who were the lawyers and all the women who were on staff. But it really opened my eyes to the fact that, oh, look, this is something women can do.
And when you were 10 or so, she remarried. I should ask you this. Was your birth father in your life at all? Or
He was up to that point, and then he wasn't for a long time, and he's now deceased. But I think to the point you're about to get to, very startling when my mom got remarried, in part because we moved from the north side of Chicago to the southwest side of Chicago, mm-hmm. because that's where his district is. And, you know Chicago very well. It's a whole city made up of a lot of different neighborhoods.
Yes, yeah, distinctive neighborhoods.
Very distinctive neighborhoods. And the southwest side of Chicago is nothing like the north side of Chicago in some ways.
Where on the north side did you live?
We were on the near north side, essentially, in between Diversey and Belmont, near Broadway.
Yeah, so we should just, for those of you who aren't from Chicago, we should point out the cultural gulf, especially at that time. I mean, the near north side of Chicago was sort of the hub of liberalism, anti-machinism. It was kind of more avant-garde in terms of culture.
Right. I think we were in the 43rd Ward. Yeah. I remember going to the very first Pride Parade when it took place.
Yeah.
And then when I moved to the Southwest Side, I remember
conservative, writing, Catholic, very Catholic.
So to your point, I remember riding my bike and being stopped by some girls roughly my age, 10, 11, and being asked what my nationality was. Well, I didn't even know what that word meant at the time. And I remember looking back at them.
This is on the southwest side.
This is on the southwest side. This is a true embarrassing story. And I remember looking at them and saying, well, I'm Catholic. They're like, no, that's your religion. I'm like, well, I know that's my religion, but I don't even know what nationality means. And it ended up, one of them said, well, look, I'm Italian, I'm Irish, what are you? And I was like, oh, okay. So I'm Spanish and French. And they're like, what? We don't know anybody like that. So, it's a different world.
Yeah, it is a different world. I mean, more than I think most other cities, and even today, ethnic enclaves, really distinctive ethnic enclaves. So Michael Madigan is a politician, professional politician. I mean, he's been doing it all
longer
his life.
Longer than we have.
Longer than me even. Yes. I mean, when I arrived in this town and I came to this campus and I started writing about politics for the Hyde Park Herald, he was already an up-and-coming leader in Springfield. So you were, if your formative years between 2 and 10, you got to hang around a law firm. Now you're... You've got a whole new world here.
Right? So school would end at the beginning of June, and all my friends would go off to summer camp, and I would go off to Springfield pretty much from the time that I was 11 until I was 18 or so.
Every summer, huh?
Every summer. And this is when the legislature used to be in session through the end of June. And as you know, all of the big pieces of legislation and the budget, they're all debated and they're all voted on during those last weeks, those last days of session. And so I used to go down and I got to be an honorary page and, be on the floor of the House of Representatives.
How'd you get that job?
It's an honorary page. Anybody could do it who came down. There were lots of people who would bring their kids and their families mm-hmm. down, particularly for the end of session
yeah.
when they were in day after day, week yeah. after week. So you had an influx of kids and family.
Yeah.
But it was this tremendous opportunity to actually see government in action that so few people get. You might go down on your sixth grade trip to the Capitol, or you might have an opportunity when you're in eighth grade to go to Washington, D.C., and again to see just for a few minutes what goes on. Or, these days you could watch it on C-SPAN or something. But, at the time, it was a lot different in the sense of you didn't have all, these different opportunities to see what was taking place. And obviously to be on the floor and to listen to the debates that would take place had an enormous impact on me. I mean, I still remember sitting on the bench on the floor of the House of Representatives when they would debate passage of the ERA. mm-hmm. and thinking to myself,
Equal Rights Amendment, yep.
Equal Rights Amendment. I think everybody knows that, David.
Yes.
But, but for those of you who may not.
I don't know.
We are here to help.
I don't know. It hasn't been debated lately.
Well, it got passed last year
here in
the state of Illinois. But what it was so fascinating to me, even at that age, was what is this debate about? How is it that we can't all agree that women deserve equal rights?
And how old were you?
I would have been 14, mm-hmm. 15, 16. So I was a teenager at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, this would have been, what, late 70s,
yeah.
early
80s? Yeah, yeah. Did you, did you have any interest in all of this before then? Or this was a whole new world for you?
It was a whole new world, and I found it fascinating.
I mean, did you see yourself at that moment when you were watching these debates going on? Did you say, I could see myself?
Absolutely not. I wanted nothing to do with it. In the sense of, I don't think I ever saw myself running for elected office. And growing up, that was a question I got all the time. Oh, are you going to run for office? And I'd say, no, absolutely not. And so, no, that was never my ambition. Until, you know, one day I really looked back and said, how can I help more people? How can I have a greater impact? And then I said, I know something I can do.
We'll get to that decision. You were not a Madigan. You weren't named a Madigan until you were 18 and you changed your name, but that wasn't a prelude to running for office.
No, not at all.
And there have been times in the last 52 years or in the last 30 where you thought that maybe being named Murray or would be a better ballot name for me.
No, you know, look, and again, we can talk more about this. Obviously, it's a double-edged sword, right?
It
brings me enormous benefits and it's brought me, you know, a series of burdens, but I wouldn't trade my father for the world.
Yeah.
Again, I feel blessed that he came into my life and has been a phenomenal father to me.
Yeah.
So no, it was all good.
So you went to, but you decided to go to Georgetown, right?
I did.
So you were going to a very political environment.
Right. I very much wanted to be somewhere around government because I had a great interest in government, even though I didn't at the time have an ambition to be an elected official. So being at Georgetown, even during the Reagan years, was a great opportunity. And in fact, you know, that's ultimately how I know you.
Right.
Because I took a chance to work on Paul Simon's staff when he first got elected to the U.S. Senate.
Yeah. And so I don't want to get upbraided for telling people what you think they already know, but we ought to explain Paul Simon because it's been
yes,
a while since he's been around. We're not talking about the singer here. We're talking about a really phenomenal guy who he got me out of journalism.
Right.
And I went to work for him when he ran for the United States Senate. He was a congressman from Southern Illinois, a guy who quit college and bought a small town newspaper in Southern Illinois and crusaded against a crime syndicate down there and fought for civil rights and political reform and very courageously and was a kind of one of a kind, big jug ears and horn-rimmed glasses, and he wore a bow tie.
Perfect voice for radio.
He did. He had he could have done the farm report
right.
every single day, but he also, I don't know if you know this, but, you know, when I was working for him, I noticed that his suits were all a little short, his pants, and I said, Paul, you know, and it turned out that a constituent had passed away and was so fond of Paul that they bequeathed their suits to him, and he never bothered to get the pants adjusted.
That's a great story, and it's not a surprise. You know, Paul Simon was an extraordinary public servant, clearly a public servant at heart.
Yeah.
And he was, I mean, everywhere we went, he would talk to absolutely everybody. And he had an ability to connect with and to engage with a broad range of people. And what I will always remember about him is that even if people disagreed with him, they respected him And he had such a following because there were some issues that he was, you know, out in front of, or he would be, you know, I would say in Southern Illinois being against the death penalty may not have been considered the politically.
Or frankly, for civil rights.
Correct. Absolutely on civil rights. But people respected him. And he always took the time, I think because of his journalism background, he was always writing, he was putting out those weekly columns, and he was explaining himself and staying connected with the public and with the voters. And so he did very, very well, and even when he left office, he continued, like you, to develop the next generation of public servants.
Down at Southern Illinois University.
Exactly.
He was in every way a lovely person. I miss him still. You left... After college, you went to South Africa, and I was wondering whether there was Paul had anything to do with inspiring you in that regard, because he was a huge proponent for foreign exchanges. He also had a big focus on Africa.
Right.
So I'm wondering how you came to make that decision.
So when I was working in his office in Washington, my recollection is that Paul actually chaired the African Subcommittee on the Foreign Affairs Committee.
Yes.
And he did an enormous amount of work, particularly in Nigeria, I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And you're 100% right about his advocacy that young people travel outside of the country so they have a different perspective and they learn about other people and other cultures. And it did have an impact on me. I already had an interest in Africa, and I had taken an enormous number of classes about post-colonial sub-Saharan Africa. And so when I graduated in 1988, this was at the time where the anti-apartheid movement was very strong, and you had universities and colleges around the country who were under pressure to divest their assets in South African companies. Eventually, Georgetown agreed they would do that, but in addition, they wanted to add something into the country. And so what they decided to do in partnership with the South African Catholic Bishops Conference is to send over recent graduates to volunteer teach in needy Catholic high schools. And so several weeks after I graduated, I got on a plane and went to Johannesburg, South Africa, and ultimately went down to a place called Montebello, which is a school that was about an hour and a half northwest of Durban in KwaZulu. And I found myself with a government degree and an English minor, suddenly teaching two giant sections of algebra. I was teaching 73 ninth graders English. I was teaching earth science. I was teaching European history. I was volleyball coach.
You must have had some late nights studying.
It's the hardest job I ever had. So it's not just preparing for the next day's class, but also grading all those papers. Teachers have a really tough job, and people need to appreciate that.
They do. And were there many Americans there, or were you alone?
There was one other woman from Georgetown, and we were it for many, 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 many miles. I mean, we would go to a town roughly 30 miles away, and they would know who we were because we were the only Americans around. So people would stop us all the time and say, "Oh, are you the American teachers?"
So, and what was it like, the environment in South Africa at the time? It was pre the freeing of Mandela.
Correct.
And the dissolution of apartheid.
Right. Mandela was still in prison at the time. And, you know, there was a low-level civil war, so to speak, going on. Now, the reality was it was the white government that was making all of that happen. But it was a really difficult time. So most of my students, they were all women. They were all Zulu. And they came from the townships outside of Durban, Pietermaritzburg. Some were from as far away as Soweto, which was certainly a long way from where we were. But the violence was such that we would learn every several weeks, certainly once a month, that somebody's father or brother or uncle had been killed. And, you know, the toll that that takes on not just that student, but on their family is significant. But, David, what was so extraordinary to me is that my students and their families recognized how important getting an education was. Even though at the time you didn't necessarily see that apartheid would end soon, after those funerals, those girls would come back to school because they knew that if they had any chance of supporting themselves, getting a decent job, really being part of the change and the liberation, that they were going to need an education. And so their families had sent them away from the township so that they could be safe and they could get an education, and they were dedicated to doing that.
How did that experience change you? First of all, were you frightened for your own safety?
No. You know, we certainly went through times where you'd go through, they had roadblocks at the time and they would stop you, or in the circumstances where there weren't a lot of us who lived. It was an old German mission that had been given over to an order of Dominican nuns. They were all Zulu. And they were running the mission, and it had an elementary school for girls and boys. There was a high school. There was a hospital. There was an orphanage there. And there were very few people who could drive. And so when one of the students would need to go home for a funeral, there were several times that I would end up driving somebody back home. And in those circumstances, it was interesting because you'd end up in a township, and the townships at the time were being patrolled by the South African Defense Forces. And they would come up and say strange things like, are you lost? Are you okay? Do you need any help? And as soon as they'd hear the American accent, they'd back off, since I wasn't a white South African.
So you would drive these young people home for the funerals of their own?
A couple of times I did.
That's moving, it's jarring.
Heavy. It's very heavy. And particularly when you understand that it's political violence. And it is, you know, I think to the outside world, it looked as if it was black-on-black violence, when in fact it was white South African government really instigating that type of violence. You know, I have to say, looking back on all of it, while I was a teacher, I learned more than I think I ever could have taught my students, and I keep in touch with some of them. And actually,
all
got
these
a
years
chance,
later, huh?
Mm-hmm, and I got a chance to see some of them this past August when I was in South Africa and Mozambique. But their commentary back to me, which I really treasure, is the fact that a young American woman who had just gotten out of college and had, you know, any number of opportunities available would come and live, you know, in South Africa during such a trying time, and showed us that we were important and that our futures mattered. And so, you know, you can never underestimate the power of simply presence. You know, I like to think that I was able to teach them some things. I like to think that I improved, you know, some people's grammar and English. I certainly did not improve anybody's grasp of algebra. But it was a unique...
That's why Paul, what you describe is why Paul thought these exchange programs were so important. I read somewhere that your dad wasn't that enthused about you.
He didn't talk to me for a long time.
Was he worried about you?
Absolutely. I mean, as any legitimate parent would be. Both of my parents were. And my mother, actually, and my grandmother came to visit me over Christmas when we were there. So I did have an opportunity to take them. I took them to Cape Town, and then they came back to school with me so they could see where I was living. But they were very concerned because all they knew about South Africa is what they would read in the press.
Yeah, which was frightening.
It was.
Yeah. You came back here, and you didn't go right to law school. You worked at Wright Junior College, which is on the northwest side of Chicago, and you got involved in a variety of community activities. Tell me about your thinking there. And I want to ask specifically about Catholicism and how that impacted on how you looked at the world and what your obligations were.
So I think I'll take your second question first.
Okay.
So to me, Catholic Christians, it's all at its heart about social justice. And so I've gotten to a point in my life where I can say, look, my mission is all about service and it's about justice. One of my favorite bumper stickers of all time is the one that says, you know, if you want peace, work for justice.
Yes.
And you know, that's just what I feel my mission is. In terms of...
That probably this experience in South Africa only reinforce that.
Absolutely. And so when I came home, I really wanted to find a job where I would have an opportunity to translate some of what I had seen and what I had learned back into communities and for people here in Chicago. Because as you can imagine, there were a lot of people who said to me before I left, look, if you want to make a difference, you don't have to go to Africa. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of problems right here in Chicago that you can address. And I didn't disagree, but I knew I wanted to give back in a way that I probably wouldn't have the chance to later in life. And so that was one of my motivators to go to Africa. So when I came back, I really wasn't ready to go to law school. But I found a job where there was this phenomenal group of women who were former Head Start leaders who were working at Wright College, and they had recently decided to partner with the 15th Police District in the Austin community, so the far west side of the city, to pioneer community policing strategies as a crime reduction method that had, at that point, not been adopted citywide in Chicago, but there were some jurisdictions in the United States where they were doing that and it was being effective. And so it was interesting. I went on sort of an informational interview that somebody had connected me to these folks, and they said to me, look, if you could do anything, what would you be doing right now? And I just very honestly said, look, I want to be, you know, helping kids. I just had this extraordinary experience in South Africa. And they looked back at me and told me what they were doing. And I said, oh my gosh, sign me up. And, you know, it was this, you know, kind of random situation. But after that, I was spending my afternoons and my weekends in the roll call room of an old Chicago police station, more along the Hill Street Blues model than these fancy new ones that look like libraries or community centers. And we were bringing kids in after school and on the weekends, and it was everybody from first graders through 12th graders. And we were trying to kind of keep them engaged in their education, but we were also trying to keep them off the streets and away from the gangs so they didn't become part of the criminal justice system. And instead, you know, they would stay engaged, get an education, and be able to, you know, help themselves and help their communities more. So it was this, you know, just another really unique and important opportunity. But it was both being in South Africa and then working on the West Side that finally said to me, oh, now I know I want to go to law school. Because I want to have a credential that will allow me to continue to do this social justice work and to help people. And so I finally decided I would go to law school. But to be honest, I wasn't so sure I was going to like it or be any good at it. So I went at night initially to Loyola, and turns out I did great and I loved it. So even though it was supposed to take me 4 years to get out, after a year and a half of doing it part-time, I, you know, squashed all my classes into the last year and a half and got out in 3 years.
And you spent 4 years in a law firm, and then you ran for the state senate on the north side of Chicago. And it was, you ran against a guy who had been there for quite a while as a state rep and a state senator, a guy who was a loyal adherent to your daddy, was a part of the caucus in the House. He also was a guy who was under indictment, I think, at the time that you challenged him, which is sadly not an unheard of development here in the city of Chicago. But he was resentful. He was openly resentful because you were Speaker Madigan's daughter, and he felt like he had been a loyal foot soldier, and now here you were challenging him. How was there awkwardness associated with that? How did that whole thing play out?
So let's talk about that. But beforehand, let's talk about the decision to run. Because back to, and this is actually something that Paul Simon used to say, and I remember this vividly when he would do Youth Government Day down down in Southern Illinois. He would always say to kids, look, nobody's parent is ever going to tell them to get involved in government and politics and to run for office. And that was certainly true in my case as well.
I saw somewhere your father said he tried very hard to talk you out of it.
Correct. And so that's what I wanted to talk about for a second. He did. He kind of sent me off on this mission of, here, go talk to these people. And I think, you know, I'm sure that, you know, he'd called all of them and said, you know, would you sit down with my daughter and tell her this is a terrible idea? And so I spent about a month going out to these lunches. And then I went back to him and said, look, I still want to do this. And you know who was the person who told me I should run for office? Paul Simon,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, the world is funny, and you just never know who you're going to meet and how things are going to turn out. But you're right. So I decide I'm going to run for the state Senate, and I live up on the north side, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, back to my, you know, roots.
Roots, yes.
Even though you're 100% right, it was, you know, just portrayed as, you know, your—
carpet bagging, exactly. District shopping, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But, so, I mean, I still remember, you know, the wards in my district. It was virtually all of the 47th Ward, which was where
Ed Bruce, Kelly.
It was all Ed Kelly.
He was, for those who don't know, and that's probably all of you, he was a powerhouse in Chicago politics for a long time, head of the Park District and a ward committeeman. And that combination was pretty powerful because there were a lot of jobs in the Park District.
A lot of jobs. So it was the 47th Ward, half of the 33rd Ward, maybe two-thirds of the 32nd Ward, and that made up 85% of my district. And then I, at the time, lived in the 44th Ward. Bernie Hansen was in charge over there at the time. So it was a couple of precincts in 43. Okay, you and I are the only people who are going to appreciate
right.
this, so I'll stop this. Yeah. But really what it amounted to—
I'm getting off on it, but— I'm thinking,
but
a lot of people out here who are scratching their heads.
Maybe you have a lot of people from Chicago who listen who are political junkies as well.
Well, we'll have more for this podcast.
Anyway,
for sure.
there were a fringe around the district of what you and I would call lakefront liberal mm-hmm. wards, and they were supporting me, whereas Ed Kelly wasn't, Dick Mell
this
wasn't,
this,
Terry
just to put
Gavinsky
it in context,
wasn't.
This is the peculiar thing about this is. All these guys were old line ward committeemen and allies of your father
right.
who worked with him in the Democratic organization.
And so they're all against me. I took 7 months off of my job. I took a leave of absence and I went door to door every single day. And some days it was 4 hours, many days it was 6 hours, some days it was 8 hours. I carried power bars in my pockets. That was my lunch, my dinner, and
those were the early days of power bars,
right? They weren't the fancy ones.
You were such a progressive; you saw the future. Yeah.
I should have invested, but I met people, and every morning I was, you know, going to the L stops and the train stops. And as you'll appreciate, right, since we're here in Chicago, it was a Democratic primary. That
right.
was the race.
Right, you win the primary,
and
here.
So it was March.
I'm hazarding a guess that Bruce Farley was not.
He was not going
not
door
going
to
door,
door
to door and not eating power bars.
Probably not eating power bars.
Yes.
And wasn't showing up at the community events that were being held. So, you know, I got to
say
what
one
I
might
to.
Not if one were under indictment.
Correct. I'm forgetting right. that aspect of it again. But so it was kind of a weird political circumstance that you can appreciate and others may be able to appreciate. But anyway, one of the things I remember going door to door and standing at L stops is there was one morning, you know, you go to these L stops at, what, 6:30 in the morning so you can see all the morning commuters. And somebody said to me, it was snowing and freezing, and somebody passed by and said, Lisa, this is the fourth time I've seen you here. We know that you're committed. Go home and get some sleep. I'll vote for you. And that's when you know, okay, maybe I can, you know, maybe I can settle down a little bit. But I won, and it was a horrible.
You won big, 2-1.
Yeah, I won big. It was a great night, and it was St. Patrick's Day, I think.
So just perfect. So even though we now know you're French and Spanish.
Yeah, but, right.
But no one needs to know that. So
they're lovely things to be.
But Irish names are great on the ballot here in Chicago, as you know. But you went to the state Senate, and you had a really interesting seatmate in the state Senate.
Oh, it worked out really well, right?
Yeah. Who was that?
So then just State Senator Barack Obama was the person that I sat next to, and we had our offices next to each other. So that turned out to be
And tell me about that. What you, I mean, I knew him back then, you knew him back then. From your vantage point, what were your thoughts about Barack, as everyone knew him, back at the in the day?
Very clear that he was super smart, ambitious, You know, he had been a lawyer, probably still was at the time, right? A lawyer in private practice, plaintiff side. He was teaching constitutional law here at the University of Chicago. You know, it seemed in some ways a little unusual for somebody with that profile to be in Springfield. But in other ways, it was absolutely terrific. He sat on the Judiciary Committee. And while there's always chatter on the floor, even when people are debating bills, he was one of the very few people who, when he would stand up to debate, everybody would quiet down because they actually wanted to hear what he had to say. Because even if they weren't necessarily going to vote for the position he was taking, they knew that he would have something to add to the debate, and he would probably be right on his position.
He, like you, had a reputation for reaching across the line to Republicans there, and he became sort of famous for building these bipartisan coalitions around some fairly difficult pieces of legislation. Some of that happened after you left, but.
Well, you really had to, right? Because at the time, the 4 years that I served in the state Senate, we were in the minority.
Yeah.
And I think that that was, to me, what was most exceptional about Barack is that he had that ability to be a leader and to get things accomplished, even when he was just, you know, first, second year in Springfield, and even though we were the minority party. So the only way you could get anything done is if you had the cooperation and the agreement of the Republican Party, which at the time, you know, it was Pate Phillip again.
Right.
Nobody, a few of us will appreciate that, but a very, you know, very different situation.
I think
the
word troglodyte comes to mind, which people may also not, but.
They know what that means.
Yeah, okay. But you can imagine. So anyway,
So here's my lesson from all of that, people. Use your phone to take a lot of pictures, because I simply don't have enough pictures from the time that we were in the Senate together. And another thing you should know is you don't know where people are going in their future. And, you know, it's another.
So you didn't say, I know this guy's going to be president of the United States someday.
I don't think any of us said that at the time, right? I mean, we served at the time when he ran for Congress against Bobby Rush and Donnie Trotter. And so I watched that whole episode, right?
Yeah.
And there was, you know, there was really that feeling, at least in that race, you know, that he wasn't from the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't black enough,
mm-hmm.
right? Which now you look back and, you know, there's some irony to that as well.
Yeah. You actually leapfrogged ahead of him for a while there, and you got elected attorney general in 2002. And one of the questions then was, and this was a place where the Madigan name was a help and a hindrance, but you hadn't practiced law very long, and were you qualified for this job? And you had a very specific view of what the job was and felt you had the right skill set for it. And it's not a criminal in the main, a criminal in Illinois. It's not. Some states, attorney generals have more criminal prosecutorial responsibilities, not in Illinois.
So in most big states in the United States, the attorney general is not your frontline criminal prosecutor. So here in Illinois, New York, California, right, they all have state's attorneys or district attorneys that they're electing out of counties to be the frontline prosecutors. So when there's a murder, a rape, a robbery, those are the people that bring those indictments. Whereas in Illinois, your state attorney general is really the lawyer for the people of the state. Of the 300 plus 400 lawyers in the Illinois Attorney General's office, 85% of them are civil lawyers. So yes, there's a criminal component, but it's a very different component with much more constrained authority than your state's attorneys. Now, there are times when the attorney general will step in to the role of a state's attorney, but that tends to be limited to circumstances where there's a conflict of interest. So if an assistant state's attorney is convicted or is picked up for drunk driving, that office can't prosecute one of their own. Or, and this happens with some frequency, unfortunately, there is a triple, quadruple murder that takes place in a downstate county where they don't have the resources to prosecute that case, then we had a very elite group of criminal prosecutors who would come in and work with that county state's attorney to effect that.
We just saw the attorney general intervene here to appeal a sentence that was given to Jason Van Dyke, the police officer who shot and killed Laquan McDonald. He got a 6.5-year sentence, and the attorney general and the special counsel who prosecuted Van Dyke are appealing to the state Supreme Court on the length of the sentence. So that's another place in which.
Right. And so
did you agree, by the way, with that decision to intervene?
I think that that was the right decision because there is an open question of law. It would take us a while to talk about it. But in essence, you're supposed to sentence somebody based on the most serious offense. And while to, you know, the average person, second-degree murder sounds more serious than aggravated battery, the reality is when you actually look at the sentences in the situation here, the second-degree murder is only a first-degree felony, whereas the other one is a Class X felony, and one of them only carries the provision that 50% of your time needs to be served, whereas the other one is 85% of the time. And so it's a little flipped, and that's why they've asked, because there is case law here in the state that would say that the judge may not have followed the law.
The last thing you did as Attorney General was to enter into a consent decree with the city over the issue of police conduct and police reform. What is the status of police community relations here? You know, this has been from the time I was first arrived here, this has been an issue. Ralph Metcalf was a congressman in Chicago who broke with Mayor Daley in the 70s over police misconduct and excessive force and so on. What did you find when you got into this issue?
So as part of the negotiation of the consent decree, the Illinois Attorney General's office actually did a whole series of community roundtables in some of the most affected communities in the city. And I was just every single night impressed with the number of people that came out to have the conversations about what they had experienced and what they were hoping for. Because there were a lot of people who said, you know what, there is community engagement fatigue. People are tired of talking about this. People just want to see change. And what we found was that the majority of people who would come out and talk about it would say, look, we understand that the police have a very difficult job, and we understand that they need more support. But what we also want is to be treated like human beings, and we want the police to know who we are, and we want the police to work with us because we're willing to work with them. We don't want bad people in our neighborhood either. We don't want crime in our neighborhood either. But when they show up and it just turns into yelling and screaming and we're called names and treated like animals, it's very difficult for us to work with the police. So I think that there is an absolute desire for significant reform and for the rebuilding of trust between community members and the police department. And I would say, you know, we also had a whole series of focus groups with police officers themselves, and they made it very clear that they haven't received the training they needed. They haven't received the resources or the support or, quite frankly, even the discipline that has been necessary to make sure that people are, you know, doing their jobs properly and not improperly. So the wonderful and hopeful thing about the consent decree is that, you know, from start to finish, we've looked at every single area relevant to policing and made provision for the policies that are necessary, the resources that are necessary, benchmarks to make sure that, you know, the training is taking place and that there's accountability. And so for me, there's real hope that after decades and decades and decades of problematic policing and problematic community interaction, that we're going to be able to rebuild that trust and really have a modern police force in the city that works for everybody.
another issue that you worked on, we spoke earlier about your Catholicism. You got deeply into this issue of the abuse of children within the church by priests, and found we had Josh Shapiro here, right, from Pennsylvania recently, who did a program with you. But you found much of the same issue, which is a much larger problem than had been reported, and a pattern of on the part of the church of obscuring these offenses. And first of all, as a Catholic, how hard was that? Was there any? Well, I guess I'll just leave it right there. I think the question is clear.
First, let me say this. You know, I have to give great credit to Attorney General Josh Shapiro, because it was really that Pennsylvania grand jury report that exposed again just the breadth and the depth of the abuse problem that has taken place in the Catholic Church in terms of, you know, the sexual assault and the sexual abuse of minors for decades and decades. And having read that report, it was gut-wrenching. As a mother, as a Catholic, as a human, it's horrible criminal activity that scarred people and ruined their lives. So to me, it was imperative, having read that and recognizing that it wasn't just isolated to Pennsylvania.
Right.
Those priests were moved around over.
As it wasn't isolated to Massachusetts when the
Correct.
Spotlight investigation uncovered this in 2002.
Correct. And I think, right, it's the combination of those two things where you like to think that there has been change that has actually been effective, and then you find out that really the Catholic Church has never come clean. And to some extent, they may have cleaned up, but there are people that, you know, we probably encounter every day who have had some form of, you know, sexual misconduct happen to them, and it is an incredible burden for them to live with that. And we really owe it to them as survivors to make sure that they receive some measure of accountability and justice from the church. And so after I read what Pennsylvania had done, I reached out to the bishops of all six dioceses here in Illinois and said that to them, look, we're going to open an investigation. I would like your cooperation. And, you know, we can either do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. And they all agreed to cooperate, and that has been true to some extent. And what was just shocking, even after a few months of reviewing files that they voluntarily turned over, is that it was very evident that there were hundreds and hundreds more allegations that had been made against Catholic priests and clergy than had ever been investigated or reported to the public. So when we started the investigation back in August, September of last year, there were approximately, I think, 140, 150 priests that had been credibly accused of sexual assault or sexual abuse against a minor here in Illinois. As we were going through files, we were seeing circumstances where there had been an investigation, and it looked as if those people were credibly accused, that that had really happened, and nonetheless, that information hadn't been disclosed. In fact, of the six dioceses here in Illinois, only two of them even maintained public list of those priests. And so as a result of our initial investigation, every single diocese here in Illinois has now published a list. They are continuing to add names to those lists, because as we're coming across people, we're saying to them, well, why isn't this person on the list publicly? And, you know, they're adding them. So, again, as I said, when we started, it was about 145. As of December, it was closer to 190. But overall, the number that we saw, 680. So there were over 500 priests and clergy members who had allegations of abuse against them, where there may have not been an investigation, or there may have been an investigation and they chose, you know, not to find that a credible allegation, or they found it a credible allegation and never disclosed it. Mm. So there is still an enormous amount of work
to
be done.
And you're of the mind that the church, that there needs to be some external process to investigate these things.
The Catholic Church cannot police itself. They've made that clear. and they shouldn't be allowed to treat criminal behavior as an internal personnel matter. Mm-hmm. That should have never happened. And I think what they have moved to is sending allegations to law enforcement, but historically they held on to them for so long that the statute of limitations had run. And so really the other question this brings up is, well, who knew what when, and was there a concerted effort to cover up this behavior so that there would be no criminal liability? And that is wrong. And so I think as these investigations go on here in Illinois and in other states around the country, there really is going to be more of an effort made to determine, are there people out there who need to take responsibility for what happened? Are there criminal prosecutions that can be brought?
You've worked in a whole range of other areas. We could take up hours talking about all the work that you did. One of them was on the issue of student loans and the consumer fraud, essentially, wrought against thousands upon thousands of young people. We've seen a change in policy on the part of the federal government under the Trump administration, Secretary DeVos at the Department of Education. Are you concerned that we're going backward?
We're absolutely going backward. I'm not just concerned. That's the reality of it. And, you know, before I left the Attorney General's office, I feel as if, what, every other week, we were either, you know, writing a letter to oppose what the Department of Education was doing or getting involved in lawsuits directly challenging what they were doing. You know, we spent an enormous amount of time, particularly in the aftermath of mortgage foreclosure, dealing with student lending because so many of the problems.
And we should point out, you were very, very active in unwinding all of that after the financial crisis and recovering some money for people who had been defrauded.
Right, and the use of that in some ways was that it gave me this expertise in lending. And almost all of the abuses that I saw in the mortgage lending industry, we were starting to get complaints about in the student lending industry. So it was everything from, you know, students being put into loans from for-profit schools where the lender knew 70-80% of these students were going to default because they were never going to get a better job because they had gone to a lousy, unaccredited school. And then when people were turning to their servicer, the person they have to make their monthly loan payment to find out, well, what can I do in terms of being able to actually not default on my loan, instead of being given the information about income-based payments, they were put into deferments that at the end of the day just increased the overall amount that they owe. So really some terrible tactics. When I was the Attorney General in Illinois, we were the ones that initiated the investigation in Navient and Sallie Mae, the largest of the student lenders and student servicers in the country. And that'll be the one issue that was not resolved while I was still there that I'm most disappointed that I didn't get to see the resolution of.
I was one of the people who tried very hard to get you to run for the U.S. Senate in 2010. And we did everything, including bringing you into the Oval Office to talk to your old seatmate about it. And you resisted. Why did you resist?
Because the authority and ability that I had as the Illinois Attorney General to make a difference in people's lives was enormous. And I felt that I would have more power as the Attorney General to...
than in the world's greatest deliberative body?
Yeah, than in the U.S. Senate, particularly if you would end up in the minority. And so you have an enormous platform and you can spend a lot of time on TV, and those are important things to do in terms of moving public opinion. But I'm a worker bee. I like to be in my office. I like to sit behind my desk. I like to directly talk to
and
people
apparently
about
the receptionist
their
desk, too, you
I'm
famously
willing to answer the phones.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. But one place where you would have potentially more impact than the Attorney General's office is the governor's office. 2014, you were pretty far down the road in terms of running for governor. And this is where life gets complicated.
Sure.
If your father is the Speaker of the House. And that issue became public in that you issued a statement finally saying you thought it would be untenable to be the governor when your father was the Speaker of the House. And he said, she always knew I wasn't going to run. I mean, this all played out publicly. Right. Strikes me as very awkward.
It's a little bit awkward, right? I mean, I think that's inevitable.
I mean, everybody says, well, didn't they talk about this stuff?
Sure, we did. And I even polled it. Look, I could have won. It would have been ugly. But at the end of the day, if he wanted to remain in the House of Representatives and as the Speaker, I just didn't think that that was the right thing to do for me and for the people in the state. And so he's been there longer, you know.
He's that's been there okay. longer than anybody.
That's right. He has been. But then I also had the opportunity to serve as Attorney General longer than anybody in the state of Illinois.
Yeah. Did that put a strain on you guys?
No, we still get along. It's all good.
Yeah. But in the moment.
Sure. I mean, as you said, it was awkward. And I think it was, you know, unfortunate. But it is what it is. And so, you know, the wonderful thing that I know from my life experience is that there are, you know, innumerable ways to serve and to make a difference. You can do that direct service teaching. You can do that as a lawyer. You can do that as an elected official. And so I'm really blessed to have served an elected office here in the state of Illinois for 20 years. I never lost an election. And I like to believe that along with the tremendous lawyers and staff that I had the opportunity to work with, we really made significant differences in people's lives.
So your months out of the office after
not
spending
even a month.
16, or not even a month, okay. And while we love having you here, I'm wondering how one adjusts after doing a job that is so high profile, so vital, so demanding. I mean, do you find yourself waking up and saying and missing it and saying, gee, I wish I was still doing that?
No, actually, I haven't yet. I've been waking up and I've had an opportunity to come and engage with bright young minds. And it has been so satisfying. And in some ways, it almost feels full circle of going back to when I started teaching almost 30 years ago. And I really have enjoyed the engagement. Because,
although not algebra, thank God. So.
No, I'm not teaching algebra. Some poor student came in and told me they had just taken their calculus midterm. And I said, gosh, I evaded calculus my entire life. Statistics, too. But it really is. And we were talking about this before we started taping. It really gives you hope for the future, particularly at a time when, you know, you look at the national politics and they appear to be rather bleak some days. Some days really horribly bleak. But there are young people. There's another generation. And that's something else that I thought about for myself is, look, 20 years, that's a long time. That's a lifetime for many people. In fact, many people don't serve an elected office for 20 years.
Well, it's certainly a lifetime for the kids you're talking to now.
It is a literal lifetime for them. And so, look, we saw it during, you know, the November elections. And you know, there's this group of new Congress people, and they're, you know, it's a huge group of women, and they're diverse. And I am so excited that I can be in a position where simply by serving during the time I did, in some ways you get to serve as a role model, and now I can be behind them and supporting them in other ways. And
do you see yourself
exciting.
Running for office again sometime?
You know what? I'm old enough, and I have enough experience that I know never to say never. But that is not something I see myself doing in the immediate future.
And do you
future.
Have any, do you know exactly what your path is from here?
Yes. Spring quarter, I'm going across the Midway and I'm going to teach at University of Chicago's Law School.
Ah, yeah. So great. So we'll just keep you on campus
That's right.
for
I'll
as,
be
as
back.
Long as we can. Lisa Madigan, it's always great to see you. Great to have you here. And thank you for your service.
It is absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit axefilespodcast.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.